Part 3. Leviathan Rising. The Globalist Allies of the URI. My kingship is not of this world. Jesus, in John 18 verse 36, you know that those who are supposed to rule over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man also came not to be served but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus, in Mark 10 verses 42-45. Point. Counterpoint. Another hierarchical project approved at a centennial conference was to take action to raise the consciousness of the 400 million mass of Russian people. In a few short years, this effort has achieved amazing results and is already an outstanding hierarchical success. It has been demonstrated that hopeless, illiterate peasants, when stimulated and given a chance, become industrial workers. Point 1. Foster Bailey, Running God's Plan, 1972. Approving the Soviet regime. Now your thought that Hitler was a monster is based on the fact that he ordered the killing of millions of people, correct? Yet what if I told you that what you call death is the greatest thing that could happen to anyone? What then? You think that life on earth is better than life in heaven? I tell you this, at the moment of your death you will realize the greatest freedom, the greatest peace, the greatest joy, and the greatest love you have ever known. Shall we therefore punish Briar Fox for throwing Briar Rabbit into the briar patch? 2. God. Talking to Neil Donald Walsh about the Holocaust, 1997. Old forms, obstructing the good, have had to be destroyed. The wrecking and disappearance of that which is bad and undesirable must ever precede the building of the good and desirable and the longed-for emergence of that which is new and better. Alice Bailey, The Externalization of the Hierarchy, approving the atomic bombing of Japan, 1945. The Cultural Revolution in China was begun a few short years ago. This also is an hierarchical project. Amazing changes have been achieved in that short period. Chester Ronning, Canada's former ambassador to China and an authority on China Today, says that the Chinese people through revolution have changed their way of thinking. This is fundamental to national reform. Foster Bailey, Running God's Plan, 1972, approving the Cultural Revolution in China. In our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible. Things like the continuation of British rule in India, the Russian purges and deportations, the dropping of the atom bombs on Japan, can indeed be defended, but only by arguments which are too brutal for most people to face, and which do not square with the professed aims of political parties. Thus, political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. Defenseless villages are bombarded from the air, the inhabitants driven out into the countryside, the cattle machine-gunned, the huts set on fire with incendiary bullets. This is called pacification. Millions of peasants are robbed of their farms and sent trudging along the roads with no more than they can carry. This is called transfer of population or rectification of frontiers. People are imprisoned for years without trial, or shot in the back of the neck, or sent to die of scurvy in Arctic lumber camps. This is called elimination of unreliable elements. Such phraseology is needed if one wants to name things without calling up mental pictures of them. Consider, for instance, some comfortable English professor defending Russian totalitarianism. He cannot say outright, "I believe in killing off your opponents when you can get good results by doing so." Probably, therefore, he will say something like this: while freely conceding that the Soviet regime exhibits certain features which the humanitarian may be inclined to deplore, we must, I think, agree that a certain curtailment of the right to political opposition is an unavoidable concomitant of transitional periods, and that the rigors which the Russian people have been called upon to undergo have been amply justified in the sphere of concrete achievement. The inflated style is itself a kind of euphemism. Point 1. George Orwell, Politics and the English Language. We do not want another committee. We have too many already. What we want is a man of sufficient stature to hold the allegiance of all people and to lift us out of the economic morass in which we are sinking. Send us such a man, and be he God or the devil, we will receive him. Paul-Henri Spaak, Council of Europe, 1949. In any case, like it or not, the Commission has to respond to an active global social conscience. In the past, people asked God to deliver them from evil. Today they look to international institutions, and in Europe that means the EU. Chris Patten, European Union External Relations Commissioner, 2000 Nothing can or ever has prevented mankind from a steady progress which has been from ignorance to knowledge and from darkness to light. Alice A. Bailey, Problems of Humanity, 1947. The Antichrist deception already begins to take shape in the world every time the claim is made to realize within history that messianic hope which can be only realized beyond history through the eschatological judgment. 5. Catechism of the Catholic Church, Section 676, 1997. As the 21st century unfolds, an ever more integrated global system demands an ever more inclusive and holistic approach to global governance. 1. State of the World Forum, Commission on Global Governance, 2003. Weak if we were and foolish. Not thus we failed, not thus. When that black ball blocked the heavens, he had no hymns from us. 2. G.K. Chesterton, The Man Who Was Thursday. Over the next 20 to 30 years, we are going to end up with world government. It's inevitable. 3. Jim Garrison, President of the State of the World Forum, 1995. The covenant with Noah after the flood gives expression to the principle of the divine economy toward the nations, in other words, towards men grouped in their lands, each with its own language, by their families, in their nations. This state of division into many nations is at once cosmic, social, and religious. It is intended to limit the pride of fallen humanity, united only in its perverse ambition to forge its own unity, as at Babel. 4. Catechism of the Catholic Church, Sections 56-57, 1997. In highly evolved societies, there is neither marriage, nor business, nor, for that matter, any of the artificial social constructions you have created to hold your society together. 5. God, speaking to Neil Donald Walsh, 1998. For reformers met under a bramble bush. They were all agreed the world must be changed. We must abolish property, said one. We must abolish marriage, said the second. We must abolish God, said the third. I wish we could abolish work, said the fourth. Do not let us get beyond practical politics, said the first. The first thing is reduce men to a common level. The first thing, said the second, is to give freedom to the sexes. The first thing, said the third, is to find out how to do it. The first step, said the first, is to abolish the Bible. The first thing, said the second, is to abolish the laws. The first thing, said the third, is to abolish mankind. 6. Robert Louis Stevenson, The Four Reformers, 1888. Many are preaching salvation of the individual through love. No one is proclaiming the other half of my message, the transformation of the species by the use of its collective scientific, cultural, and extraordinary individual capacities. 7. Christ, to Barbara Marx Hubbard, in the Book of Co-creation. There neither is nor can be any simple increase of power on man's side. Each new power won by man is a power over man as well. 1c. S. Lewis, The Abolition of Man. Humanity is poised to make inexorable progress toward creating a world that works for an increasing number of people. Indeed, in and through all the vicissitudes of contemporary history, a new cultural matrix is arising, one based on integration of all the dimensions of human life and with a new sense of personal and civic responsibility. 2. State of the World Forum, 1998. I see the great liberal death wish driving through the years ahead in triple harness with the gospel of progress and the pursuit of happiness. These are three horsemen of the apocalypse: progress, happiness, death. Under their auspices, the quest for total affluence leads to total deprivation, for total peace, to total war, for total education, to total illiteracy, for total sex, to total sterility, for total freedom, to total servitude. 3. Malcolm Muggeridge, The Great Liberal Death Wish. Christ taught also that the kingdom of God is on earth and told us to seek that kingdom first and let all things go for its sake. 4. Alice A. Bailey, The Externalization of the Hierarchy, 1957. My kingship is not of this world. Jesus, in John 18 verse 36, the coercive utopians of the 21st century. The teachings of Alice Bailey, Teilhard de Chardin, Robert Mueller, Barbara Marx Hubbard, and Neil Donald Walsh set out the theory of government and economics under a leftist New World Order. The programs of Mikhail Gorbachev, the State of the World Forum, the Earth Charter Movement, and their globalist allies describe the proposed practice. The rhetoric of Marxism-Leninism is gone. The plans for a new anthill society remain. A new order with a spiritual veneer. Gorbachev says, the socialist idea is inextinguishable. Five and vowed in 2002 that I intend to continue to contribute to building that new world order. Six, we should take Gorbachev and his visionary colleagues at their word and not dismiss them as harmless cranks. They have money, media connections, and powerful allies, and deserve to be watched and opposed. 18. Mikhail Gorbachev, man with a still unfulfilled destiny. Although Mikhail Gorbachev has been out of power for more than a decade, he retains global stature and a collectivist, messianic vision of politics and society. The socialist idea is inextinguishable. Gorbachev repudiates Stalinism, but he remains committed to the ideals of socialism and the October Revolution. In 2000, Gorbachev wrote, "The October Revolution undeniably reflected the most urgent demands of the broadest strata of the population for fundamental social change. 1. To put it briefly, October played a civilizing role in the vast expanses of Asia and southeastern Europe. 2. It should be noted that despite its weaknesses, the system that was called socialist gave people, at least a majority of working people, a minimal income necessary for life and confidence in the future, which working people in the West as a rule do not know. 3. The revolution, despite the price that was paid, brought historical renewal to Russia, freed it from the heritage of the feudal and absolutist past, and allowed the modernization of our country to begin. For in Gorbachev's view, the creation of a new civilization requires a radical change in everyone's worldview and behavior. We need a radical turnaround in our thinking, one that is global, historically long-lasting, and humanist in the fullest and truest sense of the word. What is needed is a revolution in consciousness that would provide the grounds for and ensure a new approach to the basic way of life and forms of behavior of human beings in today's world. 5. He does not specify how he would gain popular assent to this revolution in consciousness. Gorbachev's new world order would synthesize socialism and capitalism. The socialist idea has not lost its significance or its historical relevance. The socialist idea is inextinguishable. I am convinced that a new civilization will inevitably take on certain features that are characteristic of, or inherent in, the socialist ideal. However, over the course of centuries, in both politics and social consciousness, a great number of differing ideas have been churned out, conservative and radical, liberal and socialist, individualist and collectivist. This is the reality encountered everywhere. An attempt to synthesize these views, trends, and phenomena, an attempt to achieve an optimal interaction among them based on strictly humanist criteria, that is what will ensure movement toward a new civilization. 1. In 1995, Gorbachev told the San Francisco Chronicle, "The continuation of building a new world order and new international relations, this will be a long and difficult process, but certainly we should build it up instead of destroying it by unwise moves." 2. He added, "We need a new information code that will affect the press and the information systems. And we need to address the problem of crime and terrorism." 3. The new world order would be brought about incrementally, rather than by revolution. The research we have conducted at the Gorbachev Foundation has led us to conclude that it is impossible to find a way out of the present transitional period by attempting to resolve only the current ongoing political problems. It is necessary, in other words, to find roads leading to a new civilization. We understand that building such a civilization is a long-term task, although on the scale of history a task that cannot be postponed. Few people in the world are ready for the profound, fundamental changes required for the creation of this civilization. What, then, should be done? We should not try to effect immediate, all-embracing changes. Rather, we should move towards such change step by step, finding urgent solutions where they are absolutely necessary, and partial solutions where nothing else can yet be done. Solutions will gradually enlarge the field of agreement and the range of possibilities for later, more substantial measures. 4. He added, "Obviously, the goals of global management cannot be achieved all at once, in a single leap. Thus, it is necessary to approach this goal step by step, to try to enhance the role of existing institutions and encourage the coordination of the efforts of various governments. Above all, we are thinking about the United Nations. Part of Gorbachev's global management would be a new global planning agency." In 2000, he told the State of the World Forum, when I was president of the Soviet Union, I suggested to the United Nations that they strengthen the organization's environmental bodies and create an economic body to oversee the world of finance. That did not happen. As a result, there has been great disappointment since the end of the Cold War. In a book published the same year, Gorbachev said, "In the final analysis, a system for collective management of worldwide processes must be created. An effective form of collaboration based on equality among nations and peoples, we must know how to combine and jointly subordinate national interests and actions for the sake of worldwide interests and actions." He added, "What is important is that everyone must pursue the common goal, a genuine renewal of the life of the entire world community in order to arrive at new conditions of existence for the human race. Nature is my God." Gorbachev has condemned Western individualism and proposed the development of a new, nature-centered morality. He began by describing the Soviet experience as something totally unacceptable to the civilized world, namely, humanity's alienation from property and power, making the individual a cog in the wheel of a thoroughly ideologized machinery of the state. One then Gorbachev said, "On the other hand, it is increasingly evident that the values of the Western world are becoming more and more anachronistic. Their golden age is in the past. They cannot assure a dependable future for the human race. We should take a sober and unprejudiced view of the strengths and weaknesses of collectivism, which is fraught with dictatorship. But what about the individualism of Western culture? At the very least, something will have to be done about its purely consumerist orientation that emphasizes having rather than being, acquiring and possessing rather than revealing the real potential of humanity. The search for a new paradigm should be a search for synthesis, for what is common to and unites people, countries, and nations, rather than what divides them. The search for such a synthesis can succeed if the following conditions are met. First of all, we must return to the well-known human values that were embodied in the ideals of world religions and also in the socialist ideas that inherited much from those values. Further, we need to search for a new paradigm of development based on those values and capable of leading us all toward a genuinely humanistic, or, more precisely, humanistic ecological culture of living. Finally, we need to develop methods of social action and policy that will direct society to a path consistent with the interests of both humanity and the rest of nature. Point 2, Gorbachev also proposed, at the same time, we must begin to define certain moral maxims or ethical commandments that constitute values common to all humankind. It is my view that the individual's attitude toward nature must become one of the principal criteria for ensuring the maintenance of morality. Today, it is not enough to say, "Thou shalt not kill." Ecological education implies, above all, respect and love for every living being. It is here that ecological culture interfaces with religion. Honoring diversity and honoring the earth create the basis for genuine unity. Point 3, naturalistic religion is consistent with Gorbachev's beliefs. I believe in the cosmos. All of us are linked to the cosmos. Look at the sun. If there is no sun, then we cannot exist. So nature is my God. To me, nature is sacred. Trees are my temples and forests are my cathedrals. Gorbachev's smallpox horde. Gorbachev's reverence for nature did not prevent him from massive violations of treaties against biological warfare. If we face a smallpox attack in the future, part of the credit will go to him. Soviet military forces supported the socialist ideas, one of the USSR, by violating the 1972 treaty banning germ weapons. Point 2, soon after assuming power, Gorbachev signed a 5-year plan, for 1985 to 1990, that brought the Soviet Union to its high point of developing an arsenal of deadly pathogens, including plague, brucellosis, tularemia, anthrax, and smallpox. Under Gorbachev, there was no limit to the resources Moscow was prepared to invest. In 1990, $1 billion and more than 60,000 skilled workers would be devoted to match deadly germs, often in vaccine-resistant strains, with missiles aimed at New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Seattle. At the same time, U.S. scientists were collaborating with Russian counterparts to eradicate any trace of smallpox from the world, from which some 300 million people died during the 20th century, the Soviet Union was secretly hoarding 20 tons of the germ for military use. New strains were being created. All this during Glasnost. Point 3, Gorbachev ordered a halt to the Soviet biological weapons program in 1990, 18 years after the 1972 treaty and 5 years after he took power. 4. By the late 1980s, the USSR had loaded weapons-grade smallpox, anthrax, and plague onto ICBMs aimed at the U.S. The Soviet Union kept a stockpile of at least 20 tons of weapons-grade dry smallpox, at a time when smallpox viruses were supposed to be preserved in only 2 research sites worldwide. In 1990 and 1991, the last 2 years of Gorbachev's rule, Soviet researchers developed a new variant of smallpox weapons, a combination of smallpox and Venezuelan equine encephalitis. Arms reductions during 1991, the last days of the Soviet Union, left alive the Soviet Union's germ empire, history's most pestilential arsenal. 5. There are indications that Russia has continued to work on these programs, despite additional halt work orders issued in 1992 by Boris Yeltsin. Biopreparate, the agency under which the Soviets built their germ warfare arsenal from 1973 onwards, has reinvented itself as a state-run drug company. 6. Its military plants remain closed to outside inspection, and, as of 2001, the agency was directed by General Yuri Kalinin, who has run Biopreparate since 1979. The last remaining global leader? Meanwhile, Gorbachev does not view himself as a lame duck politician. A May 1997 press release from Green Cross International says, Gorbachev may be the last remaining global leader. He strikes those who meet him not as a has-been statesman relegated to the pages of history books, but rather as a man with a still unfulfilled destiny. 1. What could Gorbachev's still unfulfilled destiny be? As Gorbachev told the San Francisco Chronicle in 1995, I do believe that we need to move toward a new world order. Actually, I've never left politics. I've continued to be active politically, but I think it's quite possible that my role might change. Let's live and see. Let's wait and see. 2. Gorbachev is making his intentions clear, with repeated pronouncements on behalf of building what he calls a new world order. In 2001, Gorbachev said in response to the 9/11 attack, "It is now the responsibility of the world community to transform the coalition against terror into a coalition for a new, peaceful, and just world order." 3. In early 2002, in an interview with Crisis, a Republican Party-oriented Catholic magazine in the U.S., Gorbachev criticized President Clinton for failing to cooperate in building the new world order. "My relationship with President Clinton was quite strained, if not downright tense. Of course, it was not because of Monica Lewinsky. I was highly critical of his foreign policy. He is guilty for the fact that the U.S. has wasted those 10 years following the end of the Cold War." The interviewer, Deal Hudson, asked, "What should he have done?" And Gorbachev replied, "I think he missed out on opportunities to develop a new world order." 5. By contrast with Clinton, George H.W. Bush the Elder, admired Gorbachev. He attested to this by giving Gorbachev the George Bush Award for Excellence in Public Service in 2001. George Bush Presidential Library Foundation, the George Bush Award for Excellence in Public Service, http://www.georgebushfoundation.org/bush/asp/georgebushhayward/awardrecipients.asp, printed August 3, 04. Bush praised Gorbachev thus, "for his extraordinary leadership in guiding the people of the former Soviet Union onto a path of economic and political reform. He was a partner in the peaceful termination of the Cold War, confirmed by his strong opposition to Iraq's aggression against Kuwait. His stewardship broke barriers that separated Europe, brought a new era of cooperation, and laid the foundation for peaceful change and economic prosperity in Europe. His commitment to arms control was a key ingredient in helping to build a more secure and stable world. His legacy will be shared by all future generations, and his dedication to international peace and cooperation will serve as an inspiration to us all." The George Bush Award for Excellence in Public Service, award citation, 2001. Bush shared Gorbachev's desire to build a new world order. On January 16, 1991, during the speech announcing the start of Gulf War I, Bush said, "We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founders." He said the same in his State of the Union address of January 29, 1991. What is at stake is more than one small country, it is a big idea, a new world order, where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause to achieve the universal aspirations of mankind, peace and security, freedom, and the rule of law. Such is a world worthy of our struggle and worthy of our children's future. We will succeed in the Gulf. And when we do, the world community will have sent an enduring warning to any dictator or despot, present or future, who contemplates outlaw aggression. The world can therefore seize this opportunity to fulfill the long-held promise of a new world order, where brutality will go unrewarded and aggression will meet collective resistance. Point 1. In 1992, Bush linked his quest for a new world order to the European Union. Half a millennium ago, Portugal and Spain helped chart a course towards a new world. 500 years later, European unity guides the way towards a new world order. Those early pioneers believed their mission was to probe the secrets of the world. Now we must explore the frontiers of common interest and common ground. For almost 50 years, the West carried freedom's torch to protect the free world. Today, we stand at the shores of a new world order where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause to achieve the universal aspirations of mankind: peace and security, freedom and prosperity. A strong and united Europe offers the best hope for this united purpose and the best alliance for the United States. Point 2. In mid-2002, Gorbachev told a business convention in the UK that, "I intend to continue to contribute to building that new world order." 3. In October 2004, Gorbachev called for a new world order that will be based on strong adherence to international law. Gorbachev said the new world order he is advancing should adhere to international law, rely heavily on the United Nations, and not seek to impose the views of one country or a group of countries on others. He said the new order should be more stable, more just, and more humane. It will not deny the cultural and ethnic diversity in the world, and it will not ignore environmental challenges. World order does not mean world government, he said, nor can you build a new world order on the basis of preemptive strikes. Any attempt at building the new world order will not succeed if we ignore poverty in the world, Gorbachev said. Point 4. When the former Soviet premier publicly and repeatedly calls for creation of a new world order, it would be wise to assume that he means what says, and that he will do what he can to bring it about.